This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Tucci Ristorante, an Italian dining house honoring the memory of Mary Cipolla Matucci and the spirit of the Lido restaurant in which she worked for 50 years. Tucci Ristorante features sustainable Northwest ingredients, drinks in the Lido bar, and is open every day in downtown Lake Oswego. Information at tucci.biz. That's TUCCI.BIZ.
Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is T. Geronimo Johnson, whose latest novel is Welcome to Braggsville. He's also the author of Hold It Till It Hurts, Raised in New Orleans, MFA in Iowa, MFA, UC Berkeley. Welcome to Braggsville takes place in Berkeley and in, I guess, a fictional town called Braggsville in Georgia. Let's talk about the origins of this particular book, because you're African American and your protagonist is white, which is cool, but a little different.
Initially, I'd conceived of Darren, the main character, as being African American like myself, but when I was trying to get the book off the ground, I was having difficulty finding traction and building a story around a black kid from a small southern town who had managed to grow up, you know, live there all of his life, go off to college, and still retain a certain naivete about the reenactments. And so once I made that decision to move forward with a white protagonist, the book actually opened up in a lot of new ways that it wasn't doing so before.
Did you find any difficulty in changing that, or was it pretty easy? Because your last protagonist was a black kid growing up in a white environment.
It was very easy to change. Fortunately enough, it was early enough in the drafting process that I didn't have to go and re-envision anything. And I didn't change his name. We stuck with the same name. That's probably the easiest part of it. I mean, obviously, there's that question of what it means to write across the color line. But as an assimilated American of color, I spend a lot of time in environments where I'm one of the few black people anyway. So I think that you have to adopt a certain fluency with mainstream culture.
The other aspect of him is that Darren is coming from a southern town, and he's kind of a liberal to start, which means you're writing about an open-minded liberal kid coming from a very, very right-wing environment.
Darren, though, I think, is not too much like most of us. We tend to be a bit more, perhaps a bit more progressive or a bit more liberal than our parents may have been. Or this is something that I've observed among most of the people that I know. So on one hand, he's like any of us. But then on the other hand, he's coming from a town that has this entrenched history that goes all the way back to, they'd say, the founding of the original colonies. So he's pushing against this tradition that is not going to let him go without a fight, he finds.
When you're creating a story like this, are you thinking about the politics, or are you letting the politics emerge kind of on an unconscious way?
That's a hard question to answer, because you're supposed to put the character first. And I'm afraid if I say I put the politics first, someone who doesn't like the book will say, "I thought so." But obviously, I'm thinking about the politics first. And it's not fair to say obviously. It's just that for me, I find it impossible to distinguish between the political and the personal. Some people seem to be able to do that. But for me as a writer, I'm always interested in how these two ostensibly separate realms overlap and how they affect our lives.
What are the origins of the book? Your last one was about a kid who comes back from the Middle East with PTSD, has to deal with those issues. What brought you to write a book about college kids who decide to do a political demonstration in art in a Southern American Civil War reenactment?
I suppose that some of that comes from my being a transplant. You know, I didn't realize that I was Southern until I left the South. Being in the on the West Coast and being from the South is so interesting because in many ways the cultures are somewhat similar in terms of they're both, you know, quite laid back, and there's a lot of like formal kind of decency and political discourse that's like the social lubricant. Though politically they're different. But I remember being here, Berkeley, on two different occasions, and or rather two different phases of my life, and during the second phase thinking more so about the differences between the two. And I think it's because I was in a couple of classes at Berkeley watching how people were responding to these sorts of performances, and also just sort of observing how people respond to irony. And so there were at least two vivid instances where I remember thinking, I wasn't thinking this will make it into my novel, but I remember being just so struck by the fact that you had these conflicting interpretations of whether or not someone was trying to be serious when they were recreating civil rights era speeches. And so that stuck with me, and that ended up making it into the book. That was one of the seeds.
Well, when you sat down to write, did you have the basic outline of Berkeley kids going to the South?
Well, I knew that they had to go to the South, and I knew that there had to be a trial, and I knew that there had to be a militia, because those have grown exponentially since Obama entered the White House. And I didn't necessarily know the order in which these things would occur. All I knew at first, certainly, and this was not in the final draft, is that the book would end on a talk show.
And it didn't.
And it doesn't anymore. Yeah, and it doesn't. But that somehow I knew that we were going toward a talk show, and that if I could stage the final scene of the novel in a talk show, it would all make sense to us as Americans. There's so many interesting confessions on talk shows, and so many dramatic and comedic moments that it seemed the place to land.
Geronimo Johnson, you take off on different styles, Q&A, different points of view. At one point, having a sequence involving these characters under assumed names.
Right. Well, you know, you go wherever the story will take you. But I think that part of the challenge for me as a writer is keeping in mind that my imagined audience is not a receptive audience. I'm always trying to think of a new way to tell a story. We think that we know so many stories. We hear so much about race and class and gender, sexual orientation, and all of these topics that are wrapped in kinds of various convenient political packages. And so I think that we're resistant. And so what happens to me as a writer is I'm always trying to think of a way to tell someone what they might think they know, but in a way that they can hear it anew so they might reconsider their assumptions.
You have your dead ends doing that?
Not really, only because I'm willing to try new things. As you know, there's a thesis in there with the students operating under their informant names. So, I mean, I may hit a dead end tomorrow, but I think that the biggest thing to keep in mind, or that I try to keep in mind, is that it's okay to write a bad book. I don't know if this is a good idea, but I'm going to follow this avenue, sort of follow my impulse, and maybe I'll have to change it later.
Yeah. You don't worry about it.
No. I can fix it when I revise.
Geronimo Johnson, this isn't quite satire. Do you try to draw a distinction in what you're doing? Do you ever look and go, well, this is over the edge, or I need to pull this back, or I need to make it more realistic or less realistic?
No, I have those impulses, but it's more so around balance and a sense of how a story's kind of unfolding. I know that there's a point when a reader needs a break if it's been too heavy. There are points where you need to let off kinds of other emotional pressures, and so I do think about those things. Whether or not it's going to be realistic as such, for me, is second to the primary question of whether or not someone will be able to receive the story, whether or not it will have a kind of emotional tone that works for them, which I think has nothing to do with whether or not it's realistic.
The scenes in Braggsville, you grew up in New Orleans, which is not a little town like Braggsville, and now you're here, and I'm sure Iowa is probably not a little town either when you're hanging out with writers. What do you draw on for trying to get Braggsville right?
Well, in general, I'm a life plagiarist. I don't have to look too far to find things to write about, unfortunately. And in terms of getting it right, a little bit of research, I generally save the research until the end, and I just try to, I mean, it sounds sort of cliche, I try to write the town from the empathetic point of view of an insider and then do the whatever research is necessary to give it a shape, sort of like a shape and a social profile.
In terms of creating characters, how much control do you have? How much do you let the unconscious take over? Some writers say that the characters take over, but you know, you're still writing it.
I was in conference with a student a couple semesters ago, and there were some issues they were trying to sort out in the story. And halfway during that conference, the student said, "I just don't know exactly what these characters want to do." And I said, that's why you can't get this story sorted out, because you think it's theirs and not yours. So my general attitude is that the characters do not run the story. They do not pay the bills. They do not choose what I watch on Netflix, what I have for dinner, nothing. That said, it doesn't mean that they don't allow to kind of respirate, to take on a life of their own, but they're there to serve the larger field of the story, and I'm not patient enough, really, I think, to follow a character down some uncharted path for, you know, 2 or 3 years. I just actually can't imagine that.
So when a writer says this character forced his way into the book, you kind of look at that and go, not me?
You know, I may have even said something like that in past interviews, but it's not exactly true. It's a great answer, right? It's like that romantic notion of you're possessed by this creative spirit who moves through your tongue and fingers and takes over. And I was going to say that I wish it were like that, but I'm glad that it's not like that. Being a writer who's politically minded, it's fairly impossible for me to say I'm going to just leave the story to go helter-skelter to wherever the characters want to take it.
And that's partly because you have, as you said, political ambitions.
And then also I have a sense of how I want a novel to feel. I don't know how it's going to end. So like, I lost the talk show in maybe the second to the last draft of Braggsville, but I never lost sight of how I wanted it to feel. So at the beginning of a project, I know how I want the reader to feel when they close that last page. And so the characters always have to be marshaled in that direction.
Geronimo Johnson, change subjects slightly, because you are a political writer. You wrote an essay called Trayvon Martin Must Die. In that essay, you said, "Black kids dressing their color puts their lives at risk." Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that? And are you actually saying don't wear hoodies?
No, you know, I'm not saying don't wear hoodies. It's interesting that you found that essay. That essay is not at all saying that kids shouldn't wear hoodies. It's stating in some ways what I think might be too obvious, that there are ways that you can dress that might amplify someone's anxiety around you. And so this is the thing that you're always trying to moderate or modulate as a black male, especially once you reach that height where you look like a man. And that's the thing, you have a lot of black kids who are boys, but they're in men's bodies. As soon as they become maybe 5'5", 5'6", they have a different social profile. And so that's one of the things that essay is kind of writing around. But no, not to say that someone should not wear a hoodie.
The sense I got is that being a black man in our society, being a young black man, is by its very nature really dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I think that everyone can answer that for themselves at this point, based on what we're seeing on the news cycle. So, I mean, that's something, unfortunately, that's old news to some of us. But I'm heartened to see that there's that there's more coverage and that there's a pushback and that people are reconsidering the very nature of policing.
You're listening to an interview with T. Geronimo Johnson, whose latest book is Welcome to Braggsville. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves, and this is being recorded at Pegasus Bookstore on Solana Avenue in Berkeley. You make a comment in an interview, race has moved beyond the paradoxical and into the realm of the tragic, and we don't discuss the tragic in the soundbitosphere. And I was thinking specifically of how the mainstream is dealing with South Carolina.
That's a situation that it's, I think, impossible for many people to imagine one wanting to execute. Like, how do you get into the mind of someone who wants to do this? But part of what happens in America, I think, is that there's a naivete about just how extreme some of the extremists are. So even if he's a lone wolf, he's not really the only one of his sort. But in terms of the whole biosphere, even with the previous question, all of these can run really, really deep. All these questions run really, really deep. And so it's hard to, in like a, you know, Twitter exchange or even on a blog, talk about how these things are working in the larger, sort of in a larger sense. So like the idea with race as a tragedy is that if you look at a lot of the institutions in America that don't work, from public hospitals to schools to prisons, these are institutions that have been largely defined by race during their inception and development. And so we're seeing that the troubles that we have regarding racial tension are not just localized in terms of like individual contacts, but there's sort of a like bad programming in the very like DNA or software that's running some of these systems.
It does play back into what you're doing in Welcome to Braggsville as well. I mean, as I was reading it, this is when South Carolina was happening, and I get on Facebook and someone talks about this is the result of bullying, and I'm thinking, would you have said the same thing if it had been a black kid of 21 years old killing white parishioners?
I doubt it.
There's this double standard in America that we're not really dealing with, and it seems to be getting worse.
I don't know if it's getting worse. There's been a lot of pushback since Obama took office. A lot of people had anxiety. It provoked a lot of racial anxiety. You saw this during some of the Tea Party debates where people were yelling things like, give me back my country, as if someone had pocketed it. It's a hot topic. We're being forced to discuss it, but it still doesn't often sound as though we're discussing it as thoroughly and as thoughtfully as we need to. We're just discussing it more frequently, but I don't know that we're discussing it any better.
How do you finally bring it to the surface so that people who say, we're not a racist country, can maybe open their eyes to white entitlement?
You know, the problem there is that I'm completely looking to white people to educate other white people. That's just sort of where I am on it. Part of the biggest reason being that as soon as I enter the conversation, there's a little bit of an effective filter. Of course I'm going to say what I say. Of course I'm going to think what I think, given my upbringing in this country, given my profile, my appearance, and who I am. And so I will engage in these conversations sometimes, but I really think that for our social evolution to make the kind of quantum leaps that it needs to make, white people are going to have to educate each other.
What do you think you as an artist can do in that respect?
I try to do the same thing that I do for each book. I write from my heart. I don't think about othering or crossing the aisle. I'm dealing with people who have, like all of us, inherited a less than perfect system. And I try to illuminate the very real and human burdens and challenges of trying to be yourself and do the right thing in a system that, when you stop and think about it, I really don't know how anyone grows up in America and isn't a little bit racist, homophobic, sexist, et cetera, et cetera.
T. Geronimo Johnson, speaking of homophobic, partway through the book you decide to bring in gender issues as well.
You know, the funny thing is that the gender comes in halfway through the book, but I didn't wait until halfway through the book. That's not when I decided to bring it on. I felt like it was important from the beginning. And, you know, this is the interesting thing also about the race discussion, that like people will talk about racism, or they will talk about women's reproductive rights, or they will talk about gay marriage, but no one, or seldom does anyone, talk about them as being issues that all illuminate very common core prejudices and anxieties about population control. I mean, I just feel like it's right there. I mean, everyone can see it. We've gone from, for blacks, we've gone from slavery to Jim Crow to the carceral state. For, you know, white women, this resurgence and this anxiety about birth control is best expressed when John Tanton just comes out and says directly, as he does on record, that in order for America to maintain a clear white majority, they're going to have to take certain steps. And you can unfold all of these issues like this.
Because your views are that strong.
The funny thing is, I don't think of my opinions as being that strong. I just think that perhaps I'm more willing to look directly at what we have.
Geronimo Johnson, you do any research on reenactments?
No reenactments were hurt in the writing of this novel. I have been around them. I have observed them from a safe distance. Maybe the closest I've been is from here to like the building across the street. I know that there's no reason I can't go. There's just some part of me that every time I approach the reenactment, kind of, it's like there's an invisible fence and I just end up turning around. So I might go at some point in the future, but I didn't go when I was working on the novel. And when I lived in the South, I didn't want to go.
What's the relationship between elements of Southern culture in the book and, say, the culture of New Orleans that you grew up in?
Well, I suppose in both regions there's a sense of history, and there's a sense of a history in a location that predates the states. So the history of Braggsville goes back to a time when America wasn't America. They go back to one of the early ships landing. Same thing with New Orleans. How are they the same, I think, is hard to say. It's hard to articulate. In some ways, to me, they feel like my parents' house and an aunt's house. So New Orleans is like my parents' house, and then Braggsville in Georgia is like my aunt's house, where they share a lot of things in common. And I feel comfortable in both, but they're not quite the same.
You devote a lot of time to barbecue. Why is that?
Who doesn't love barbecue? Who doesn't love barbecue, right? And it ends up being a stand-in for so many things. I read a review that informed me of yet another symbolic role that barbecue holds in the novel that I hadn't thought of beforehand, but that fits nicely. And I suppose in this instance, while I'm a fan of it personally, it's a great social occasion, it was such fun to play with because all of the students had in the book had different expectations of what it means, because that first stand-up routine takes place at a barbecue, so it sort of like sets it off as a special emotional space.
Before we started, you were speaking with someone about changes in New Orleans. I know your first novel has Katrina in it, and you know, I saw Tremé and True Detective, and there have been a lot of books about corruption in New Orleans, most centering on how bad New Orleans is after people left. And yet you were talking about, in some ways, how good it's become.
I'm not sure that that's what I was saying. Oh. I suppose that the gist of that conversation was that neighborhoods that you wouldn't have expected to turn around and be gentrified have turned around and become gentrified. And there's new lifeblood flowing into the city, but we we kind of ended with acknowledging that not everyone has been able to return. Most likely, everyone will not return. Many people have resettled comfortably in other places, but the gist of that conversation was not that things are summatively better.
What's the Ninth Ward like now?
I haven't been for, I think, 18 months. So I have no idea what it looks like now. I know that the last time I was driving through the city, I was keenly aware of the spots of renovation and then of the kind of the swaths of areas that had not yet been touched.
Did you get to see Treme?
I like David Simon's work. That show did not pull me in, though. That show just did not pull me in.
What do you see as the future of New Orleans, then?
I don't know, but if I had to speculate, just because, I mean, I worked in real estate in Atlanta for over a decade, so if I had to speculate based on what I've observed, I'd say that eventually the city is going to be gentrified, but that's what's happening in every major city in America right now. People who have, you know, not become homeowners or didn't have, weren't part of a strong tax base are being pushed out, you know.
T. Geronimo Johnson, what are you working on now?
I'm working on a post-apocalyptic novel, and it's got a little bit of homeschooling in it.
Do you like writing essays?
Not really. And my editors probably figured that out by now.
How about writing short stories?
I did for a while, but I'm a serial monogamist, so I only work on one project at a time. So that means that, for example, all the 7 years I was working on Hold It, I could make notes, but not write a single short story. Same thing when I was working on Bragsville. So I don't know that I'll have a short story out anytime soon.
And because you're in Iowa and you teach, can writing be taught, really?
Oh, of course. A lot of people say that, and I think it's because they have a hard time articulating what it is they do. But it's like that old Smith song, that joke isn't funny anymore. I don't. You know, a lot of teachers say that, and I'm not sure it's good form to say that you can't teach something that you're being paid to teach. And you know, the thing is, just as someone taught Miles Davis the, you know, basic chords and basic notes, there are things we teach in writing, things to do with form, things to do with sensibility. And so the question is, can you teach someone to be creative? No, you can't teach someone to be creative. And then also, maybe can you teach someone to have the kind of sensitivity people want writers to have? So, you know, can you make the moral education part of it come together? And that, not necessarily. But you can teach people how to write. You can't necessarily teach them to care.
Geronimo Johnson, any interest from Hollywood on either of your two novels?
I have a reason to smile.
You've been listening to an interview with T. Geronimo Johnson, whose latest novel is Welcome to Bragsville. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
For more information about this show, go to bookwaves.com. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
Muy buenas tardes, esto es Tania Gomez-Aza para KBOO News. A continuación, un corte informativo en español para el día martes 4 de agosto de 2015. La organización no gubernamental Freedom House instó el día de hoy a las autoridades federales mexicanas a investigar el asesinato del reportero gráfico mexicano Rubén Espinosa, quien fue encontrado muerto el pasado fin de semana en la Ciudad de México, junto con la antropóloga y activista Nadia Vera, Yesenia Quiroz Alfaro y dos mujeres más. Espinosa trabajó para la revista Proceso, el portal local ABC y la agencia fotográfica Cuarto Oscuro. Rubén Espinosa ya había denunciado en múltiples ocasiones amenazas y ataques en Veracruz, estado que ha sido considerado como el lugar más peligroso para la prensa en América Latina.